Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we examine the mindset, the trends and changes of a globally connected right wing, then turn to solutions to the growing animosity between identity groups. Three experts join us. Dr. Lawrence Rosenthal is chair and lead researcher of the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies. He's the co-author of Steep, The Precipitous Rise of the Tea Party, and The New Nationalism in the First World War. Brian Levin also joins us. He's director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and a professor of criminal justice at California State University, San Bernardino. He's co-author of the book, The Limits of Dissent, and co-author of Report to the Nation, Hate Crimes Rise in U.S. Cities and Counties in a Time of Division and Foreign Interference, and Posing the Why Question, Understanding the Perpetration of Racially Motivated Violence and Harassment. Irvin Staub joins us. He is Professor Emeritus of Psychology and the Founding Director of the Psychology, Peace, and Violence Program at University of Massachusetts Amherst. His books include The Psychology of Evil, The Origins of Genocide and Other Group Violence, The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive Caring, Moral Courage, and Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership and Heroism. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the three of you, really experts in this field, together from really three different disciplines so that we can try to understand what's happening in the United States. Lawrence Rosenthal, I thought we would start with you in terms of understanding the scope and the trends, both of this, what we're now calling alt-right and related movements in the U.S., perhaps what you've deemed illiberalism. How would you describe what is happening, its scope and trends?
Well, one thing that's really important to understand is its international dimension. And the alt-right in the U.S. is very much connected to similar groups abroad. And illiberalism is about the wearing away of the principles of and norms of functioning democracies. And there are any number of strong men leaders throughout the world, of which Donald Trump is one, and others are people like Orban in Hungary and Putin in Russia and Erdogan in Turkey, and it goes on and on, Modi in India. And their followers tend to be people who have bought into very strongly a version of nationalist ideology. What's unusual about this moment in terms of nationalist ideology is in the past, you think about the 30s when fascism was rising, you didn't have an ability for fascist movements in various countries to really affiliate with one another, essentially because they all felt their nation was greater. I mean, how can you have an international movement with people who think they're the master race? Doesn't work. But now there is what I think we could call a common other. And the common other frequently consists of immigrants, frequently consists of people of color. And so internationally, there is a kind of bond around the idea that traditional societies, traditionalism, as they would render it, which sometimes goes by the name of Christian society, Christian Europe, traditional Europe, and things of that nature, but often goes by the name, and more frequently, the discrimination is white versus others. And this is the, if you wish, the contribution, the export from the USA into this international mix. There are things which come from abroad. For example, the idea of replacement, that immigrants are going to replace the white population. So there's this feedback. But really significant is the place of white as the discriminating factor between us and them. And increasingly, the support of strong men in power, people who are similar to Donald Trump.
So let's look specifically at the U.S. too, given the sort of what appears to be a rise in violence, especially in hate crimes. Let's bring Brian Levin in. Brian, you've been actually calculating this. Year over year, it looks like hate crimes have increased. Can you break this down for us? How much has it changed?
The good news is we're below where we were in 2001. So that's at least the good news. You know, interestingly, if you look at a long-term chart, hate crimes have been on a general decline from 1996 through 2014, interrupted by 2001. A general downward trend. What's been very interesting, though, and distressing, is according to FBI data, we bottomed out in 2014 at just under 5,500 hate crimes. Last year, there was just, 2017 rather, there were just under 7,200. So we went from about 5,500 to about 7,200 approximately. What we've been doing is looking at America's largest cities. And in 30 of the largest cities, not the 30 largest cities, but most of the top 20, we found that in those cities, in 2018, hate crimes rose by 9%. It's the steepest rise that we've seen since 2015. Additionally, 47% or 14 of the 30 cities hit decade highs, including places like Los Angeles, Chicago, Washington, D.C., and many others. Moreover, white supremacist extremist homicides have really eclipsed everybody else. In 2016, we had approximately mid-60s overall extremist homicides in the United States, mostly by violent Salafist jihadists. And that was the case the year before as well. We had the horrible San Bernardino massacre, which hit our community. But listen to this. Since then, 2016, we had 3 white supremacist homicides. The next year, 2017, it rose to 13. Next year, 2018, it rose to 17. And in 2019, the white supremacist extremist homicides alone, just through August, now outnumber every extremist homicide of any stripe that took place in 2018.
So these are by the perpetrator. What about the victims?
Interestingly enough, over the last quarter century, we've generally seen hate crimes occur, the top targets, African-Americans, Jews, gays, whites, Latinos. And interestingly, I think we've had a bit of a democratization. And here's what I mean. In 1996, we had a peak other than 9/11 time. And in that year, African-Americans accounted for 42% of all hate crimes in the United States. In 2017, the last year where we have data available from the FBI, it had shrunk down to 28%, which is the lowest proportion of hate crimes that we've seen for African-Americans of all hate crimes. And there seems to be a reshuffling of things. And what I mean is, in 2015, anti-Muslim hate crimes jumped 67%. And December of 2015, when we had a combination of the San Bernardino terror attacks on December 2nd, and then 5 days later, candidate Trump launched his Muslim ban proposal, that month, December 2015, and I want to credit the actual brilliant person in the mix who helped us all put this together, my friend Jim Nolan at West Virginia University. What we found was that was the third worst month for anti-Muslim hate crime, only behind October and September 2001, when there were many, many more. But nevertheless, when candidate Trump spoke 5 days after 9/11, hate crime spiked by 23% above the 300% spike that we saw from the terror attack. And the spike that I'm talking about, I just want to make sure people understand. The first 11 months of the year, we had a daily average of hate crime against Muslims. During the 5-day period after the San Bernardino terror attacks, that spiked to over 300%. And after candidate Trump spoke of the Muslim ban proposal and actually rolled it out, in those days and the days that followed, the increase was over 400% of the average daily number of hate crimes against Muslims and Arabs, or a 23% increase above the terrorist correlated spike.
So if we are going to draw from these trends, what are the big takeaways in terms of what's happening? Do we have an idea of, for example, you said that the white supremacist perpetrated hate crimes sounded like they were relatively small numbers, but the hate crimes themselves, which encompass a much bigger, you know, circle.
Well, I was talking about homicides. I was talking about homicides with regard to white supremacists, not all hate crimes, just homicides.
Right, right. So I was trying to distinguish that out so that people understand that we first were talking about homicides, but then you broaden that out into actual hate crimes, which is a much broader category. And so if you are going to draw some conclusions about what's happening in the United States right now, what would be the most important conclusion that you would make?
The most important conclusion I would make is that we oftentimes will see these precipitous spikes around a catalytic event or some emotionally charged issue. And moreover, there seems to be a political nexus. And here's what I mean. August 2017, Charlottesville month, that was tied for the second worst month for hate crime in this particular decade that we're in, 2010 on. The worst month for hate crime overall this decade was November 2016. And moreover, and I found this incredibly interesting in trying to figure out how to unpack it, when candidate Trump launched his campaign and made derisive statements about Mexicans, day by day tick, FBI did not increase with regard to anti-Latino hate crime. However, when did it increase? It increased in November 2016 when Latinos bore the brunt, at least percentage-wise. They had the biggest percentage increase in that time right around and after, right after the election of any group, even though Latinos were kind of flat for 2015. And I think what happened was the red meat segment of the angry electorate, I think, was going to be Muslims in 2015 and 16 when we had a much higher number of violent Salafist jihadist homicides. Also, in 2015 and 2016, if you look at most of the opinion polls of the electorate, terrorism was the top issue. Since then, last year, anti-Muslim crimes declined precipitously, both in our numbers and CARE's numbers. But anti-Latino hate crime went up. So I think we're seeing a reshuffling of the deck chairs about who is the legitimate political target to launch aggression towards. And I think that that has an impact on hate crimes as well. One other quick thing, though. Last year, 2018, around election time, if you drew a line, San Diego, Orange County line in California, all the way across the United States, generally, you'd find that cities below that line that were generally red cities, San Diego, Texas region, Arizona region, we didn't see a spike around election time. But in cities north of that region, we often did. New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, all had increases either against the prior month or prior year during that time. And the cluster of white supremacist homicides last year were roughly around election time, a little before. One other quick point, because I think I hope some of your listeners will help us unpack this. October 2008 was also a bad month for hate crime. And it looked like that's when President Obama was about to win the election. So is there something where if it looks like folks from the left or people of color are going to win, the hate crimes rise before? But if someone who's more left or not a person of color wins, it comes after. We'll have to see. Correlations do not necessarily represent cause.
Right. Too many factors to control for.
Sure.
So, Irvin Staub, I'd like to bring you in. You know, you've studied violent conflict all over the world. You've also studied reconciliation all over the world. When you look at what's happening both, you know, globally, the way Lawrence Rosenthal described, and also here in the United States, the way Brian Levin has broken down the numbers, how would you see this in comparison to the kinds of conflicts you've studied?
I think what we have here is a little bit different, quite a bit different, but also there are some similarities. I mean, first of all, to state the obvious, we have a leader who incites people. That's very significant. He incited people from the very beginning that he started to run for president, and he continues to incite people in all kinds of ways. It's also a broader question to me than just the people who commit hate crimes, because they act in a context. The context, in addition to this leader, is that he creates a tremendous amount of confusion. He creates chaos. Several influences that usually contribute to political violence in a society between groups. One of them is the very difficult conditions of life in a society. Well, we don't have that. But the another one is political confusion and disorganization. And we do have that. There is incredible confusion and disorganization. As part of that is a tremendous amount of division between us and them. And a core influence of leading to violence between groups is devaluation of the other. If you look at other people and see them as more us than them, and you have a positive view of them, it's very unlikely to have violence. But devaluation creates violence. Another thing that's very important in all societal violent situations is that there is an evolution. Violence can begin, and people change as a result, and they justify what they are doing with an increased devaluation of the other, seeing the other as immoral, seeing the other as dangerous to ourselves, seeing the other in all kinds of negative ways. And so that's a significant problem. But I am also interested in who are the people who follow Trump. I have done research some years ago on what I came to call blind and constructive patriotism. Now, patriots are people who say, I love my country. Blind patriots seem to say, I love my country no matter what it does. And they have some interesting characteristics. One of them is they don't expose themselves as much to political information. Another one is they don't like other countries to do the kinds of things that they feel belong to their country. So, for example, blind patriots don't like other countries to play baseball because that's our thing. Another thing is that they are lower on a measure that includes a positive view of human beings, empathy for people, and a feeling of responsibility for others' welfare. Also, given that they like to enhance their own country, the kinds of things that Trump does, enhancing America in relation to all foreign countries by distancing from allies and speaking negatively about allies, this feeds the kind of people who follow him. And I would think that the people who we are talking about, the ones who engage in hate crimes, are an extreme group within this larger group of people who love the fact that we are going to be great and we are going to be special and we don't have to regard other people, and there are a whole lot of other people in relation to whom we are better and can raise ourselves up. If this is okay, I just want to shift a little bit to the fact that we have changed as far as mass killings are concerned. We used to say a lot about how sorry we are for people and our heart goes out to you. We still say that, but less. Why do we say that less? Because it's all over the place. We get totally accustomed to it. You know, it's a very disturbing kind of evolution, what is happening. And I have been watching very carefully the media. People are talking all the time. The police is talking, everybody is talking. What is the motive of this person? Is that really a point? What's the motive of this person? Then anybody can pick up a gun and go around shooting. So we are not addressing the relevant issue. I have been watching CNN. Nobody there was talking about how we have to get rid of AK-47s. Finally, this is beginning to emerge. But the political situation is not very good for that. You know, if you look at Mitch McConnell, he has not allowed any kind of gun control legislation to move forward. Every year, there are gun control proposals. Last year, there has been a significant one by Dianne Feinstein. Does Mitch McConnell and all, anything constructive go forward? No. So the question is, what are we going to do? Yes, there are many hate crimes. Yes, there are many mass killings. Yes, it is a terrible situation. But we have to look at it and ask, why is this happening? And I think it is happening because the kind of people that support Trump, I think it's happening because the way he incites people, it is happening because there is no political process to try to stop it. It is happening because the amount of confusion and disorganization that has been created in the country has a very bad effect on people.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the mindset, the trends and changes of a globally connected right wing. So I wanted to get into some of the policy and political issues as we went on as well, but let me just turn it over to Lawrence Rosenthal now.
Yeah.
Would you agree with Irvin's assessment?
One of the things he pointed out was that the shooters, the violent people, to put them into context, that they are not, the phrase comes out these days, lone wolves. There are no lone wolves anymore. In a world that is so networked and the alt-right is so networked that to speak of lone wolves is completely misleading. But what they have in common with Trump followers is this notion that white people are being displaced by people of color. If you remember Charlottesville, there were three well-known chants from the people marching with tiki torches the night before the violence really hit. And one of them was blood and soil, and another one was Jews will not replace us. Those kind of were almost taken straight from Nazism and didn't quite translate as well as the third one, which was simply, you will not replace us. That chant goes to the heart of what Trump followers feel most strongly and what they have in common with these people who perform massacres like we've seen in El Paso. And there's a couple of things to say about that. One is that the country is becoming majority-minority, and this is an assault on... Sociologists use the word status as though there is a panic about racial status among largely white Christian Americans. And the phrase, you will not replace us, is also something which connects, as I suggested earlier, the movement in the USA with movements abroad. And that gives it an awful lot of strength. You know, Steve Bannon, when he left the White House, started going around the world, Europe and Latin America in particular, attempting to create a kind of illiberal international, you could call it, or a nationalist international. And it was on that basis of all of these various polities and nations, which had a population of largely right-wing populists who were feeling this sense of displacement or replacement. And Bannon is one of these people who says this is about economic issues. It's about the deindustrialization and the immiseration of middle class and working class people, all of which has happened. But that's not how they sell Trumpism. That's not how they sell any of this. I mean, just think of Trump's campaign. It is about that the immigrants are bringing crime, they're threats to our people, they're going to rape our daughters, and things of that nature, all of which are the red meat that mobilizes this antagonism around feeling that you're being replaced. And this is what the Trump voter has in common with the shooters.
I was wondering also about the sort of anti-political correctness meme that is going on now and how much that is feeding this.
Trump in his campaign, if you remember, often said the biggest problem in this country is political correctness. And that basically, what he's getting at has two pillars. One of them is feminism and the other is multiculturalism. And on that basis, you could almost call it the organization or the mobilization of resentment was very effectively carried out. And this was, in fact, the specialty of things like Breitbart News. And they would send out people like Milo Yiannopoulos, who would put things on the internet that attracted what we used to call in this country alienated young men, for whom the idea that multiculturalism, other groups, and feminism, women, were getting power in a way that explained their own sense of powerlessness. And a great deal of the successful political organization and mobilization of Trump supporters occurred via this use of political correctness, specifically feminism and multiculturalism, to kind of stir up the passions of alienated, especially young men, and especially, you know, there's a whole category of young men on the internet who are gamers and so forth. But beyond that, you know, it is larger than that, but that's almost a kind of prototypical example. And there's this whole part of the alt-right, which is sometimes called the alt-light, which sort of was playful on the internet and created characters like Pepe the Frog. And the effect of the Trump candidacy was, in effect, to make Trump the king of the world of Pepe the Frog. So you would get Trump done as Pepe. And the merger of Trump with this kind of alienated culture was extremely effective and continues to be in creating widespread support that was absolutely crucial in his election. And where it stands today is, I think, a bit on a knife's edge. But in answer to your question about political correctness, it is vital, really, to understand the place of how that operates as a lever for this kind of politics to kind of go viral.
Irvin Staub, please come back in.
Sure. I was saying something about difficult life conditions affecting people, and one of the things that generates violence in a society or hostility and anger, and group conflict is another one, and then political disorganization is another important one, and great social changes are all also very important. Now, what do all those things do? You know, we human beings have some core universal psychological needs. I have not met yet a single person who said, I don't have these. One of them is a need to feel secure, a need for security. Another one is a need for a positive identity. A third one is a need for some degree of effectiveness and control over important events in our lives. Another one is a need for connection to some important people or groups. And then there is a profound need to understand the world and our place in it. So there aren't difficult conditions in the usual sense. But, as our other speakers have said, people feel deeply threatened by the coming in of so many people into the country who are Hispanic, who are seen as others, by so many people in the country, by all the changes also in the world that deeply affect them and makes it difficult to have control over things. Now, this is all true, but it's magnified greatly by this terrible Pied Piper, Donald Trump, who blows the horn of all of these things. And even people who may not have experienced it on their own, when they are introduced to all these ideas and pointed to all these others who are criminals, who are murderers, who are bad people, who take away your livelihood and all that, then it's going to come alive. And if it was already alive, it is going to be magnified a very great deal. So I think that the combination of certain things happening in the world and this person so intensely magnifying it creates a terrible problem. Now, I want to say a word about multiculturalism. It's an interesting kind of multiculturalism if you watch CNN and you also watch Fox. I like to see what happens on the other side. My side is liberal, but both sides are highly problematic. If you watch CNN, there is nothing on CNN, at least later in the day, than knocking Trump all the time, without stop, without anything else on it. And there is nothing on CNN than on Fox than defending Trump no matter what. I mean, really, if you listen to Hannity, if Trump walked down the street and shot a baby, Hannity would defend him forcefully. So we live in such a divided and divisive world. It goes beyond issues of political correctness. It really goes to a core sense of who we are and what sense do we make of our world when it is possible to see it in such different ways. So is it possible to kind of create some kind of a sense of unity in the country? The Democratic candidates talk about that. They are not doing it so far. But can we do that? Can we give people who are so alienated and so threatened to give some kind of sense of security and sense of agency and sense of hope and sense of connection beyond their own radical group?
So, Irvin Staub, I know that's one of your areas of specialty, so we're going to come back to you and have you answer that. Brian Levin, was that you?
I would like to add one point to what Irvin had to say, which is that the fear of the other and the capacity to be manipulated, as he pointed out, by the demagoguery of Trump. It's an interesting thing. Studies demonstrate that it is most effective among people who are distant from real immigrant communities. People who actually live around immigrants are far less susceptible to it. It's almost as though it's not simply the other who is the frightening image around which Trump voters organize and mobilize, but it's almost a fantasy other. It's someone who you haven't had real contact with, and that allows that kind of vacuum, allows it to be filled with these images of hateful, criminal people who have to be defended against.
Can I just say one sentence? At some point, there was substantial anti-Semitism in Japan, a country without Jews.
Yeah.
Like Poland after the war.
Yeah.
When we come back, we turn to solutions to the growing animosity between identity groups. Stay tuned.
welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we examine the mindset, the trends and changes of a globally connected right wing, then turn to solutions to the growing animosity between identity groups. Three experts join us. Dr. Lawrence Rosenthal is chair and lead researcher of the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies. Brian Levin also joins us. He's director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and a professor of criminal justice at California State University, San Bernardino. Irvin Staub joins us. He is professor emeritus of psychology and the founding director of the Psychology, Peace, and Violence Program at University of Massachusetts Amherst. So, Brian Levin, you've been kind of quiet for a while. Let's bring you in. What do
it's
you
just think? A joy listening to these scholars, you know? I mean, I'm happy to just be at the table. I've enjoyed them both.
So in terms of, you know, we're kind of talking solution orientation a little bit here. Like, is it possible to actually bridge between such groups? Is it possible to give this kind of agency and security and positive identity? Would that make a difference, do you think, in the sort of crimes that you examine?
I think that one of the things that's happening, and we have our report, you can find it at Prof. Levin, it's 137 pages, and it's free. And there's just certain points when we were putting together the report, aside from the hate crime stuff that I thought were interesting. One was a real decline in trust in the communal institutions which define our values and hold us together. That was something over the last 50 years. We're also diversifying, and the group that is diversifying the most are young people. What else have we seen? Pew did a study and found that young people were constantly online, much more so than their older relatives, for instance. And also young people tend to be more tolerant, but they're also in the most rapidly diversifying demographic age cohort. And I think what we really have to have as part of our communal education is a little history, a little civics, as well as something else. The rise of conspiracy theories, critical thinking. And on the other side, if I may, I think one of the things that sometimes on the left, I think the left can be, and I'm not talking about in the same manner like white supremacy, but I think that the notion that somehow if you disagree with someone on something, on a policy, that constitutes hate speech, or that people who are mainstream conservatives shouldn't be invited to campuses, gave the hard right the kernel of truth that they needed to take everything out of context. And let me tell you, even with the hate crime data, things are so highly charged that people respond emotionally. So I think a couple of things that could be done is if we had civic leaders who role modeled dialogue, who role modeled critical thinking, and we had education that really focused on some important issues. There was a recent study that came out of Americans, and it showed that the millennials were woefully undereducated about such things as the Holocaust. So I think there's no one magic wand to this, but rather a series of steps that are about civil society, and that's the first step to having an embrace of bigotry. Because what happens is, in the absence of this, particularly when we have what we're having now, as Pew indicated, we're not only the most polarized we've been in decades, we're the most entrenched in this polarization, and we don't have the honing of not only the critical thinking skills, but these critical thinking skills have been replaced by an emotional visceral response where insult ascends over fact.
So this is, of course, the whole purpose of the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for it.
You know, there are a few things. So, you know, my area of study is, you know, media messages, framing and meaning making from that and the connection to emotions and that sort of a thing. You know, I was perusing your website, Brian Levin. I was looking at the idea of speech and the idea of fact. But in contrast to, you know, conspiracy theory, like you're talking about, or what we might deem as hate speech, and how do you reconcile, you know, these ideas between, or these principles between trying to get people to think critically when the conspiracy theories actually contain anti-intellectual, anti-critical thinking, and anti-science, anti-fact even, then alongside with what we might call hate speech. And I know that's a legal term. I use other terminology sure. in my scholarship. But so this is one of the areas that I'm wrestling with, is how do we reconcile this?
Well, I could address that a little bit, that the kind of rejection of science and fact and so forth is rooted in a rejection of the class of people who seem to embody that. In other words,
yes,
it's a resentment of what's perceived as a liberal elite who basically they think they know everything and want to tell us how to live our lives and that kind of thing. So that it's what you describe as a rejection of fact, I think, is a secondary, in a funny way, a secondary phenomenon to a rejection of the messenger. And so if there was a route to undo that, perhaps that route goes through some kind of reestablishment of reasonable connection between the populist right and what Steve Bannon calls the administrative state.
Brian Levin?
This point that was just made, I think, is critically important. This decline in trust in institutions is partly because these institutions are regarded as not only elitist, but disenfranchising people who are seeing all kinds of change and are having trouble making sense of it. And the elite folks don't respond, I include me in that, in quotes, aren't responding to these folks at a visceral level. In other words, people are sometimes made to feel uncomfortable. I was talking to a sociologist recently, and a person of color, by the way, and he said, you know, we have to be able to embrace people who might be fearful of change and sometimes a little ignorant without calling them on the carpet. You know, like, here, why don't you try this food? Ooh, I don't like it. That doesn't mean you're a bigot. It just means you don't like that particular food. And I think one of the things that we're seeing, if there's one word, I would say is fragmentation, social media, politics. Look how many people we have running for president. And I think that's hitting a vein where at the root of this, at least partly, is the fact that these institutions were either slow to respond or unresponsive, not to the bigotry and all that, but to some of the underlying concerns about, for instance, a shift, and just bear with me, when the Klan hit it big in the 20s, what did we see? We saw a changing world, America out of an international conflict. We saw technology, birth of a nation, radio, a jazz era decadence is what they would say. All these changes, a shift to an industrial economy from an agrarian one, a shift of a population from rural places to cities, and an influx of immigrants. And what happens in those instances, and that's when the 1924 Restrictive Immigration Act was passed. In those instances, when people are under fear, they are a lot more susceptible to accepting bigotry than when they're not.
Irvin Staub?
To go back to your point about language and thoughts and so on, there were a group of terrorists in prison in Egypt, and there was a very high-level imam who came to prison and regularly met with them and talked about the Quran, which they interpreted in a certain way, and he reinterpreted the Quran for them. And after some period, they wrote a manifesto, these former terrorists in prison because of their activities, in which they proclaimed that their activities were wrong, that what they had done wrong, and they wanted to start in a new way, getting to people through the words, through ideas, through ideology, and working with a different ideology. You know, one of the problems in every group violence situation is, in addition to devaluation, in addition to scapegoating, is that people usually turn to or create what I call a destructive ideology. On the one hand, the ideology is good in some way for that group. On the other hand, it identifies an enemy who stands in your way. So one ideology here can be that we want America to be great, and these people who are the outsiders, who are aliens, stand in the way of the greatness of America, or something else. Very interesting forms of these destructive ideologies, like the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia talked about total social equality, a society of total social equality, but they identified people who they thought stood in the way of this and had to be eliminated. So that's one thing. But the problem, of course, here is that with social media, with the incredible multiplicity of voices, with Trump and Steve Bannon and other people, how do you access people and work with them and the way they think about the world and reality and what is right and what is not and what is harmful to them and what is not? So there is a real problem here. One other example, which may be relevant here, is another group of terrorists who were incarcerated. One way to try to transform them was to start to support financially their families. That is, the very people who caught them and jailed them began to support financially their families. And then began a transformation. Suddenly, there was a connection to these others whom originally they tried to kill and who now put them in jail, benefiting people at a place where they live, their wives, their children, and other people. And then finally, I don't know quite how we can do this, but deep connections to others and working together for shared goals, constructive goals, makes a huge difference. You know, the European Union, before it was established, various countries created joint projects. There was some kind of a big steel project that involved several countries and other things. And that was a movement. Both goodness and evil involve evolution. They involve step by step, and people get transformed along the way. Now, I am not quite clear how you could get these people, but we are not only talking about terrorists. We are talking about the base that they live in. We are talking about the community from which they come, and to create and engage people in those communities in some kind of a way to constructively create projects that benefit them, that benefit the country in their view, and so on, it could make a huge difference. It's a core issue because change requires emotional engagement. And when you work together with other people for shared goals, you are emotionally engaged and you come to connect to these other people whom you are working with.
Wow. So the question on the table then is there a joint project? Well, the country, well, the community. And I imagine that in some ways there is, instead of this bridging that we're talking about, there is antagonism coming from some of the rest of us. Would you think that's true, Irvin Staub?
Yes. Somebody said that these people feel looked down upon. Many of these people feel looked down upon. And I think that is true. We don't open our hearts to people who are so different and who may support Donald Trump. My God, how evil can they be? But not everybody who supports Donald Trump is necessarily evil. You know, what could create joint projects? A huge rebuilding of the infrastructure of this country in which people get jobs and get respect in working. Where people are invited in to do this. I mean, you all know, of course, FDR's work programs. that depression could have created a lot of problems in the country. Well, there was anti-immigrant sentiment there. In fact, it was such strong anti-immigrant sentiment and anti-Semitism that FDR did not allow Jews from Germany to come into a country, even when there were already quotas for them. But that's another story. The story I am trying to say is creating huge infrastructure projects and inviting people in and creating joint work and maybe giving people some autonomy so that within that context they could create joint projects so that they feel a stake in it and they feel empowered and they feel significant. That could make a difference.
Well, let's do sort of a final conclusion. Brian Levin, what would you say as your concluding thoughts?
There's one word I've mentioned before that is a good starting point is fragmentation. Not only are we becoming more diversified, but we're not unified in that diversity. Moreover, the social media landscape, the cable news landscape, as we've heard discussed in this fascinating conversation, continues to be fragmented as well. And what I think we're seeing a bit is a democratization of hate. So, for instance, in 10 of the cities that we looked at last year, although whites are a relatively small number, they had the largest percentage increase. And indeed, in 2017, most of the FBI categories for hate crime went up. So what I'm afraid of is we have to try to put together some communal values, attach that to institutions, and let people know that they're being heard. Because when that doesn't happen, when we have these fissures that spout, this toxic magma of bigotry can crystallize when people think that they're not being heard and they're being disenfranchised. And I think a good point that was made with some of these people who have been involved in these mass killings, they're cleaving away from families and they're out of high school, but the jobs that they get and the future that they see isn't as rosy as they perhaps thought. And indeed, the killer in El Paso wrote about his lack of ability to get jobs going forward. And I think that's something. Automation and immigration are changing things. And I think what we have to do is prepare folks for a bit of a changing world, but do so in a way that I think encourages them and is not conflictual. And we're not quite there yet. One last thing. I think that the first thing that we put up in our report about things that can be done is using the bully pulpit to help take a diverse society and unify it.
Lawrence Rosenthal.
I was struck by Irvin's suggestion of a works progress kind of solution, and I think there's a lot to that. The question is, how is it possible to re-engage conversation in a country that's become so fragmented, was Brian's word. People frequently talk about communication silos and so forth. And another thing that Irvin suggested was how people feel looked down upon. And the truth is, at this point, liberal America has been scolded around this ever since the election of Donald Trump. We have been told these people are tired of feeling looked down upon. And there's a lot of truth to that. That is true. But if you pay attention to right-wing websites and things like that, the word for, you know, looking the other way through the telescope of that feeling resentment about being looked down upon, the look downer us upon, they're engaged in contempt. And if you look at, pay attention to right-wing extreme websites and websites of, the Tea Party, which no longer really exists, but has been superseded by the Trump movement, their contempt for liberals is at an extraordinary level. It is the idea that liberals are stupid and mentally ill and so forth is a taken for granted thing. So it's important to understand that while there is this resentment of being looked down upon, there is also, and this is a function of having been mobilized, of having been stirred from simply feeling resentment, that there's a kind of flip and they feel contempt for liberals. So that the question of how do you make these groups in some way be able to communicate with one another. It's not simply a question of the liberal world saying mea culpa for looking down on people. It's that back and forth is far more complicated. And so Irvin's suggestion that a solution may be found, and I think there's a lot to this, a solution may be found in the circumstance of actually working together of things like infrastructure project. As I suggested earlier, actual face-to-face contact with the other is perhaps the most successful means of cutting through hate and dismissal and contempt for others.
Well, Irvin Staub, Lawrence Rosenthal, Brian Levin, what a fabulous conversation. I thank you so much for sharing your research and your thoughts and your insight with us and our listeners. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria.
Lawrence Rosenthal is chair and lead researcher of the Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies. He's the co-author of Steep, The Precipitous Rise of the Tea Party and The New Nationalism in the First World War. Brian Levin is director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism and a professor of criminal justice at California State University, San Bernardino. He's co-author of the book, The Limits of Dissent, and co-author of Report to the Nation, Hate Crimes Rise in U.S. Cities and Counties in a Time of Division and Foreign Interference, and Posing the Why Question, Understanding the Perpetration of Racially Motivated Violence and Harassment. Irvin Staub is Professor Emeritus of Psychology and the Founding Director of the Psychology, Peace, and Violence Program at University of Massachusetts Amherst. His books include The Psychology of Evil, The Origins of Genocide and Other Group Violence, The Roots of Goodness and Resistance to Evil, Inclusive Caring, Moral Courage, and Altruism Born of Suffering, Active Bystandership, and Heroism.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankinia Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.